From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Alan Greenspan talks about his 18-year tenure as chair of the Federal Reserve Board. He's written a new memoir, which coincides with questions being raised about his role in the creation of the subprime mortgage meltdown. We'll talk with Greenspan about that crisis, the Bush tax cuts, Black Monday, irrational exuberance, and more. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Two Lives, Gertrude and Alice, about Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas. It's by Janet Malcolm, who also wrote a book about Sylvia Plath and Ted Hughes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The publication of Alan Greenspan's new memoir, The Age of Turbulence, coincides with criticisms that he's partially responsible for the current subprime mortgage crisis that has led to problems in the markets and the larger economy. Greenspan was the second longest-serving chairman in the history of the Federal Reserve Board and one of the most powerful. He was appointed by President Reagan in 1987 and retired from the position in 2006 after having also served under Presidents George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and George W. Bush. During Greenspan's tenure, the Fed brought interest rates to their lowest levels in years. Critics say these low interest rates made possible the adjustable rate mortgages with the low teaser rates that enticed people to buy homes and left many of them defaulting on their mortgages when interest rates went back up. In response to the crisis and instability in the markets, today the Fed lowered the key interest rate for the first time in 4 years, cutting it by 0.5 percentage point. Alan Greenspan, welcome to Fresh Air. What are the risks of dealing with this financial crisis by cutting interest rates? Are there risks to doing that?
There are, but there are risks to doing nothing, and there are risks to cutting interest rates. And I'm frankly quite comfortable that the skill of the Federal Reserve Board, the staff, and its chairman are such that they'll do the correct balance and come out the right way.
Let's start with some of the criticisms about your role in creating the mortgage crisis, which has led to a wider financial crisis. And there have been a lot of criticisms of your 3 years of very low interest rates and how that might have led to, led to the mortgage crisis. Let me just read a couple of quotes. This one is from John Cassidy, contributing editor of Portfolio Magazine. And he says, by keeping interest rates too low for too long, Greenspan encouraged a borrowing-fueled speculative binge, which has now given way to a credit squeeze. By failing to crack down on the mortgage industry, he allowed subprime hucksters to peddle dubious loans, which the financial industry's math whizzes packaged for investors. Alan Abelson, a columnist for Barron's, wrote on August 13th, Greenspan went far beyond the call to entice people, no matter what their circumstances, into buying a home by whacking the cost of credit to as near zero as you can get and urging them to go for those newfangled adjustable mortgages with deceptively low interest rates. Do you think you contributed to the crisis by lowering interest rates to 1% and keeping them very low for 3 years?
I do not. First of all, let's understand that we are dealing with a global situation where not only has there been a housing bubble in the United States, but there have been bubbles of a significant dimension probably in 20 or 30 countries throughout the world. And if you match them, the United States' bubble versus, for example, Britain, Australia, Spain, and a large number of other countries, we're subnormal in that regard. So that the notion that somehow what's going on in the United States is the result of the Federal Reserve moving short-term interest rates when housing is determined by 10-year or 30-year mortgages is just factually inaccurate.
The low interest rates coincided with or led to new kinds of mortgages, you know, adjustable rate mortgages, mortgages with low teaser rates where on the ground level you pay next to nothing in interest, but then the interest rises and you're possibly going to be hit with an interest rate that you no longer can afford. And that's how a lot of people defaulted, and that's in part what led to the whole mortgage meltdown, which leads to a question I want to play for you. I recently interviewed Robert Reich, who was the Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration. You probably know him from those days.
Quite well, yeah.
And I told him in the interview that I was going to interview you. And I asked him if he had a question that he'd recommend I asked you. And I want to play you his response to that. Here's his question.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing you might ask him, and I'd love to ask him this question. In fact, maybe I'll just call him up one day. I know him. Why did the Fed reduce interest rates so dramatically in 2002 without increasing the supervision of the lending institutions that would obviously use such cheap money to get a lot of people to borrow, maybe irresponsibly if they were not sufficiently overseen. Having created the conditions for cheap money that led to the prime mortgage meltdown, why didn't the Fed do more to try to stop and regulate those mortgage lenders?
Well, Alan Greenspan, you heard Robert Reich's question. Yeah. How would you answer it?
Well, basically, the whole subprime mortgage issue and the role that the Fed played in it, and indeed that I played in it, which was part of your last question, which I didn't get a chance to answer. I think let me just start off for a minute with what the facts are on the question of whether I encouraged various forms of subprime lending that was adjustable rate, which is the critical question here. Because remember, there is a good deal of subprime lending which is largely fixed rate, and they are doing exceptionally well. And remember, we want to encourage subprime markets basically because what they are doing is allowing lots of people in lower income groups to become homeowners. And when you have a capitalist society of the nature in which we do, and property rights are critical, the system will not be able to sustain itself unless it has the support of the populace. So I have always been a supporter of broadening the issue of mortgage markets so that lots of people could actually become homeowners. There is a risk in that, but the risk is small relative to the advantages that we get. Now, with respect to my issue here about encouraging this, there's been very poor reporting on this. It all comes from a speech that I made in February of 2004, which I reported on some very interesting analysis by the Fed staff about the costs involved in taking out long-term mortgages if you are the type of person who may only plan to live in the home for 2 or 3 years. Doing an adjustable rate mortgage under those conditions makes a lot of sense. And when I made that particular speech, the notion that subprime mortgages were rising and becoming important was never on the table. So that when I was asked a week later at the Economic Club of New York, was I essentially degrading the 30-year mortgage and in favor of the adjustable rate mortgage, I said, no, I was talking about a very special case. And indeed, whenever I took out a mortgage, it was a fixed rate 30-year mortgage. I thought that the actual insurance that you take out against interest rate changes, in my judgment, was worth it.
So let me get to Robert Reich's question again, though. Yeah. Like, his question is, when interest rates got so low and all these new mortgages came about, why didn't you do more to supervise the lending industry, knowing that they might, you know, they might do predatory things?
Yeah, for very good reasons. First of all, there is no question in my mind that there were a good deal of predatory lending going on. This type of action, which is essentially fraud, is a criminal offense and something which Federal Reserve regulators or examiners are ill-prepared to actually supervise. And indeed, we were very good at looking at balance sheets and judging concentration risk, but extremely inept on all criminal issues. And I've argued very strenuously that this is the job of state attorney generals. And I say in my book that we're dealing with a situation which you need more, not less, addressing of fraud, because it's very dangerous for the market and it's very dangerous for the people who get caught up in that. I was very concerned if we would get engaged with our capabilities trying to address the subprime issue and the adjustable rate mortgage issue, because I was, and a lot of my colleagues was aware that we're dealing with the types of organizations that if we were seen as regulating them, they'd put that fact in their window. And my fear is that instead of actually improving the situation, we could very well have made the situation worse. So all in all, the subprime problem is indeed a derivative of the housing boom generally, which in turn is the result of very strong global forces over which neither the American Central Bank or any other central bank had any particular control.
If you knew then what you know now, would you have done anything differently?
I doubt it very much. In fact, I find myself looking back at that particular period, and while obviously we would have preferred that we were not in the particular bubble, I thought that the actions that we were involved in were the correct actions, and I do to this day.
My guest is Alan Greenspan, the former chair of the Federal Reserve Board. He has written a new memoir called The Age of Turbulence. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Alan Greenspan. He was the chairman of the Federal Reserve for 18 years. He has a new memoir called The Age of Turbulence. Let's talk a little bit about your work with the George W. Bush administration. You served with both President Bushes. Let's talk about George W. Bush. When President Bush was inaugurated, there was a huge surplus, and that was left over from the Clinton administration, and that actually worried you. You say in your book, chronic surpluses can be as destabilizing as chronic deficits. Why were you worried about the destabilization aspects of a surplus?
Yeah, strangely enough, my realization of what the problems were came as a real shock to me, because I never thought with the propensity towards spending more than our incomes, we would ever get to the point where we would be concerned that there was too much surplus. The problem is a technical one. If you have budget surpluses which are reducing the national debt, at some point the national debt will disappear, and indeed it was projected to disappear in 2001 by the year 2006. And if you have continuing surpluses, and they were at that point projected at $500 billion a year, after you've paid off all of the debt, you have to accumulate private securities. And I was very much concerned that, having watched the administrations of Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, that having huge quantities of private instruments, bonds and stocks and the like, which would let them, if they chose, to control what the private sector was doing, was a very dangerous trend. And indeed, I must say that President Clinton had some smaller version of that. And when he told me subsequently, when he heard my arguments about it, he dropped the idea.
So you were worried that if the government ended up investing a lot of money, a lot of surplus in the market, that it would be unhealthy for the market and would give the government too much control.
Very much so.
So when President Bush proposed his massive tax cut program, your first impressions were?
I thought the ideal solution to this was to cut taxes in a manner which, by the time we got to 2006, the surplus had disappeared. And indeed, either the Bush tax cut or what was in fact the Democratic leadership cut, which was somewhat smaller, would have served my purpose. I was in favor of a tax cut, not necessarily the Bush tax cut, and I made that very clear in my formal testimony before the Senate on that issue.
So you wanted a tax cut because you didn't want too much of a surplus, because you didn't want the government investing a lot of money in stocks and bonds and therefore having too much control over the market
And American business and jobs.
Right. Okay. But then when you saw the magnitude of President Bush's tax cuts and when you watched him keep cutting taxes, even when the fiscal situation had changed, when there was no longer a surplus, when there was a war in Iraq, when there were soaring deficits, at that point, what did you think of the Bush tax cuts?
Well, I was arguing that the tax cut needed to be matched by a reduction in either spending or other taxes, because we eliminated, regrettably, as the surplus began to arise, all of the fiscal restraints that had been put in place 10 years earlier. And indeed, I testified on several different occasions to that. I always made my support of any of the tax cuts conditional on cuts in spending.
Were you surprised to see Republicans like President Bush and others in his administration turning against deficit hawks like the president's own Treasury Secretary, Paul O'Neill? Did it match with what you expected from a Republican administration?
No, it did not. I thought that that was most unfortunate, and indeed where I've had my strongest concerns is the fact that we have this major problem confronting us with a very substantial number of the baby boomers just now beginning to retire, and that volume is going to turn into a flood as we get into the next decade. We have not properly funded Medicare. Indeed, by some estimates, it's only half funded. And what we have promised a very large number of people are Medicare services which, under the current law and the current expectations of the economy, government is not going to be able to deliver. This, to me, is unethical, if not bordering on the immoral. Because remember, if people knew that they would not be able to get as much Medicare as they're currently being promised, they would take actions about their retirement. They might delay retirement, they might do other things. But to confront them with the fact that they will not be getting what has been promised after they've retired is really very unfair.
Did you ever hear President Bush worry about how he was going to fund the war in Iraq, how he was going to pay for that?
Well, you know, what's interesting about this is that the war in Iraq costs a lot of money. But when you compare it to the size of the economy and you look back at Vietnam and the Korean War and obviously World War II, the actual amount of GDP which is being absorbed by both the war in Iraq and Homeland Security and all of various other initiatives that occur after 9/11 is still a very small number, because it's only a little over 4%. The defense budget overall is a little over 4%, and it got up to 4% of GDP, and it got up to 8 and 9% during the Vietnam War, and is, I think, over 14% during the Korean War. So the issue has never really become an economic issue, because it seems absurd, of course, that the huge amounts of money that are being spent for the war are not impacting the economy. But the truth of the matter is we have grown to such a huge economy that we're actually able to absorb it without any indication or any negative effects occurring within the domestic economy.
I guess what you're saying confuses me, because, you know, as we were saying, when President Bush took over, there was this huge surplus, so big that you were worried about it being far too big. And now there's this huge debt, in part because of the war in Iraq coinciding with these huge tax cuts. Are you saying you're not concerned about the amount of debt that we face now as a nation?
Well, actually, it's the debt levels relative to GDP, and indeed the deficits relative to GDP are historically quite small. The real problem is not now. It's our just utter lack of attention or failure to even want to confront the very substantial problems for financing Medicare, especially in the years ahead. And I must regrettably say that is true both of Republicans and Democrats. I'm listening to the debates that are going on amongst those who are seeking the presidency, and nobody is recognizing what every technician has been telling all of the politicians, that this issue has got to be addressed. If we don't, it's going to create very serious fiscal problems for the country. It's not the current data that are so critical. It is basically the failure to address the future.
Alan Greenspan is the former chair of the Federal Reserve Board. His new memoir is called The Age of Turbulence. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. From the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, supporting educational, cultural, and environmental initiatives to make our world more livable. On the web at grdodge.org. And from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure that life-saving advances in health reach those who need them most. GatesFoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews a new book about Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas by Janet Malcolm, which uncovers details about their lives in France during World War II. And we continue our interview with Alan Greenspan. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Alan Greenspan. He served as chairman of the Federal Reserve Board from 1987 to 2006 and was one of the most powerful chairs of the Fed in history. He's written a new memoir called The Age of Turbulence. When we left off, we were talking about how we went from a huge budget surplus during the Clinton administration to a huge debt during the Bush administration. Greenspan was saying he's not so worried about the money we're spending in Iraq. He's worried about how we're going to finance Medicare as the baby boomers become eligible for benefits. You've complained that people in the Bush administration have said deficits don't matter. Are you saying the same thing?
No, I'm not. I'm just saying that the size of the Medicare problem, the deficit that will be coming from the Medicare problem in the years ahead outweighs even the very large impacts that the war costs are. I'm trying to say that we've got to address the Medicare issue, and unless we do it very soon, we're going to find that we're creating very serious imbalances in the American economy. And what I'm concerned about is every revision or expansion of Medicare is more rather than address the financial problem. I mean, for example, one particular problem which I had with George Bush was his prescription drug program for which he created no means of financing. This is a huge number, and unless it's essentially addressed along with the other shortfalls in Medicare, we have very serious problems. I'm not downplaying the issue of what the war is costing, because the war is costing us a very great deal of money, and I must tell you I've not been a great fan of the way this has all turned out. Where we really have to act now is on Medicare, where the orders of magnitude of the numbers are much larger than even the large numbers we're now confronted with on the war.
Just briefly, what kind of action would you like to see?
On the Medicare issue?
Mm-hmm.
I would like everyone to recognize that, remembering that Medicare is not a financial issue, it's real resources. We need to make certain that there are an adequate number of hospitals, physicians, nurses, and a whole medical infrastructure, including a pharmaceutical industry, to supply the medical services which this very large retired population is going to require. And that in order to do that, we have to realize that we cannot solve the problem by raising taxes, because there comes a point in which you actually undercut the ability of the economy to grow and create tax revenues. So every analysis that I've seen basically says no matter how you solve or fund this problem, taxes are not enough, and there have to be some adjustments in the basic underlying Medicare benefit. And if we're going to do that, it is essential that we communicate to the retirees that there will be some adjustments, because there have to be one form or another. My solution, and I suspect it's more a forecast knowing the way politics work in this country and know what the economics of it are, is that we're going to end up with people like myself paying virtually all of the medical costs myself, in other words, 100% co-payments. And it will be very substantially the case that the upper, middle, and upper income groups will be getting ever less Medicare assistance, and that Medicare will be essentially for middle classes and those for anyone, say, below a certain level of income. We can afford the entitlement for everybody, and I think we must focus it on those who are most needy and require it. That's the solution which is going to come out politically. The sooner we do it, the better off we are.
You write in your book that the Bush administration turned out to be very different from the reincarnation of the Ford administration that you had imagined, and that in the Bush administration, the political operations were far more dominant. And you say about George W. Bush, for many party leaders, altering the electoral process to create a permanent Republican-led government became a major goal. What did you witness of that, of altering? Do you feel like you witnessed that firsthand?
Well, I was observing like everybody else. First of all, you began to get various leadership in the House talking about the smaller government, which is fundamentally the principles of the Republican Party, which I was familiar with. Remember, I'm sort of I'm in the libertarian wing of the Republican Party, and to me, smaller government more freedom, more civil liberties are all part of the type of post-Enlightenment society I would like to live in. And I think that Republican views essentially go around. What I began hearing is something quite different from that. And ultimately, as I say in the book, that the Republican Congress swapped policy for power and in the end achieved neither.
Let's get to Black Monday, October 19th, 1987, when the market dropped 22.6%. You'd been chairman of the Fed for only 72 days when that happened, so you were pretty new to the game. What were the things that you worried about most on Black Monday?
American economic and financial history, because never in my experience had we seen a sharp decline of that nature without eventually destabilizing both the financial system and the economy. And indeed, the next several days were highly unstable, and we came a lot closer to really serious contraction than I think anybody realized at that time. And then, for example, the New York Stock Exchange was in a position where it thought it might have to shut down because their bids for stocks were disappearing. And had we shut down the New York Stock Exchange on the day or two after Black Monday, we would have had very considerable difficulty reopening it, and that could have had major negative impact.
Why would it have been hard to reopen it?
Well, basically because when stock markets are falling, people are very frightened. They see their net worth going down, and even though they often know that if they sell at that particular point, they may be doing some silly thing, but the physical pain of watching what was going on was such that they needed to disengage. If on top of that you eliminate the actual potential safety valve of liquidating, which is the market being opened, you create a much higher level of fear, which could impact directly on economic activity. And that was something which we tried to avoid under all circumstances.
My guest is Alan Greenspan, the former chair of the Federal Reserve Board. He's written a new memoir called The Age of Turbulence. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Alan Greenspan, and he was the chairman of the Federal Reserve for 18 years. He's written a memoir called The Age of Turbulence. I want to ask you about two famous words that you used on December 5th, 1996, in making a speech to the American Enterprise Institute, the conservative think tank. You said, "How do we know when irrational exuberance has unduly escalated asset values?" And after you said that, markets around the world dropped. I guess they figured you were getting at something here, that we were actually facing irrational exuberance.
You know what's interesting about it? It was actually a question, how will we know when?
Mm-hmm.
The market interpreted it as we have and are involved in irrational exuberance, and we're going to get very severe consequences as a consequence of that. It's one of those very odd experiences I had as Federal Reserve Chairman. When I thought I was discussing largely an academic issue, I recognized that if one thought about it, that we were approaching a bubble and a lot of people could get concerned. And indeed, they did. I mean, the Japanese market, after I talked it in the evening, went down. But within 2 days, it was back where it was.
How did you come up with the words irrational exuberance?
I wish I hadn't, but it actually captured exactly the issue I was trying to make, because exuberance is a normal human activity which is a potent force in market expansion. Irrational exuberance is when you project that exuberance in a manner which is utterly realistic for the future. And that was precisely what I was concerned about, because it's that state which is when bubbles burst and everyone runs in the other direction.
How do you deal with your own portfolio when you're worrying about like the nation and the world economy?
Well, frankly, when I was chairman of the Fed, I realized that any actions I would take would have some effect on my net worth. There was no way to get out from under that fact.
Mm-hmm.
So I called together a little group of senior financial experts within the Fed to craft a policy for me which would insulate me as much as possible. And I guess I went out of way to see that my rates of return on assets were below normal, and I must say I succeeded.
Is there any kind of rule requiring you to like put your stocks in some kind of blind trust or something so that you can't intentionally manipulate policy to improve your own portfolio?
No, strangely, aside from the issue of owning stock in banks, there are very few restrictions on what Federal Reserve governors can do with their own personal finances. But we had to go far beyond, or I had to go certainly far beyond the letter of the law, because I was acutely aware that even holding currency would have potential implications on my net worth by the actions we took. It was one of the more difficult problems I had.
My guest is Alan Greenspan. He was chair of the Federal Reserve for 18 years. Now he's written a memoir called The Age of Turbulence. You met Ayn Rand at a very important time in your life when you were a young man. Was it just out of college?
Well, I was 26, I believe.
Mm-hmm. And
It was just, I guess you'd say it's out of college.
And, you know, Ayn Rand described herself as an objectivist, and she and her followers believed, among other things, in unregulated capitalism. And you, of course, spent a good deal of your professional life as a regulator at the Fed.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you both believed in what Ayn Rand believed, and also you describe yourself as a libertarian, and a libertarian, of course, is somebody who wants minimal government regulation. You say that when you first became head of the Council of Economic Advisers, you knew that you would have to pledge to uphold not only the Constitution, but also the laws of the land, many of which you thought were wrong. And I was wondering, which ones? Which ones did you think you'd have the hardest time following?
Well, there were a lot of them, but remember that the critical issue is we live in a democracy. And a democracy means we all have differing ideas. And if we're going to get a rule of law, a lot of us, indeed probably all of us, have to compromise to certain extents, not with our fundamental principles, but with how we think various different situations should be governed. And I concluded, as much as inaccurately thinking that I would have to become a significant regulator as a Federal Reserve chairman, it turned out that I didn't, that the general focus of regulation in the Federal Reserve was not all that different from where I had been. But I was confronted with the question, do I want to be a pamphleteer economist advocating positions, which I am obviously admit is a minority position, or do I want to get involved and try to move things at least somewhat in the direction of my libertarian views, if I possibly can? And I chose the latter, but I was very much acutely aware of the fact that if I believe in the rule of law, I've got to abide by the law, which means including those laws with which I disagreed, and I endeavor to do that during my career.
How did you reconcile being a libertarian, not wanting government intervention and regulation, and having one of the most powerful regulatory positions in the country and, in a way, in the world?
Well, actually, we were not fundamentally a regulator. The vast proportion of our efforts were not involved in bank regulation.
You're regulating interest rates, which have a profound effect on world economies.
Yeah. You're raising a really very interesting question. I have always argued that the gold standard of the 19th century was a very effective stabilizer. It kept inflation essentially at zero, and I thought it was critical for the tremendous growth that occurred in the American economy in the latter part of the 19th century. And when we went off the gold standard in essentially 1933, we then had to have what we call fiat money, which is essentially money which is it's printed paper money, which unless we restrict the volume of, can be highly inflationary. And what the type of interest rate regulation that I, and indeed most central banks in the last 20 years have been involved in, more than that I suspect, has been to try to replicate the laws or the rules that were governing the gold standard. And so it's an odd situation where all central bankers, while none of them are advocating a return to the gold standard, nonetheless try to replicate the various types of interest rate policies which the gold standard would have been created. And it's an interesting question whether you call that regulation or basically functioning of a central bank stabilizing the economy.
Alan Greenspan, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Alan Greenspan is the former chair of the Federal Reserve Board. His new memoir is called The Age of Turbulence. Back in the mid-1940s, Greenspan played in a jazz band called the Henry Jerome Orchestra that included people who became better known for their music than he did, like Al Cohn and Johnny Mandel. But it also included Leonard Garment, who later served as special counsel to President Nixon. Here's an air check of a radio broadcast featuring Greenspan with the orchestra.
Well, I don't care how far rigor mortis would have set in. Here's a tune that when you hear the Henry Jerome arrangement of it, you just got to get up and dance no matter what you're doing. It's just you, just me. Dig it.
Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews a new book about Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas by Janet Malcolm. This is Fresh Air. On her deathbed in 1946, Gertrude Stein turned to her companion of nearly 40 years, Alice B. Toklas, and reportedly asked, "What is the answer?" When Toklas was silent, Stein went on to speak her famous last words, "In that case, what is the question?" In her new book on Stein and Toklas, called Two Lives, writer Janet Malcolm discovers still more questions, silences, and some answers about the life that Stein and Toklas shared together. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
If you want to read a genuinely haunting piece of writing about the limits of language as a means of nailing down truth, read the conclusion of Janet Malcolm's 1995 book on Sylvia Plath and Ted Hughes called The Silent Woman. In the last pages of that book, Malcolm describes her visit to an elderly man who was once Plath's neighbor. She steps into his kitchen and sees rotting food, boxes, papers, garbage, and dust upon dust everywhere. Rather than skedaddle out of this hellhole, Malcolm sees the kitchen as an embodiment of the difficulty anyone faces when trying to write. The doomed effort of selecting out of the jumble of one's memory and imagination just a few telling words. That ending to The Silent Woman is so defeatist, it could have served as Malcolm's own way of giving notice as a writer, biographer, and literary journalist. But self-consciousness about the art of writing isn't a crippling condition for Malcolm. Rather, it's her obsessive subject. Whether she's investigating shenanigans in the Freud archives or techniques of photography or journalistic ethics, she's always also ruminating on the essential conundrum of writing, that by ordering thoughts and impressions into narrative, a writer simultaneously reveals and distorts truth. It's little wonder, then, that Malcolm has finally turned up at the doorstep of Gertrude Stein, the modernist writer whose sentences resist the straitjacket of grammar and whose big baggy books defied editing. Stein's voluminous writings are about as close as we come in canonical American literature to that chaotic kitchen. And so part of the delight of reading Two Lives, Malcolm's provocative book on Stein and her longtime companion, Alice B. Toklas, derives from watching Malcolm, who's such an elegant and precise writer, discover the fun of wallowing in Stein's mess. As always with Malcolm, Two Lives is many books at once, most obviously a slim biography of Stein and Toklas that zeroes in on their life in France during World War II. It's not as though no one has ever before raised the question of how two Jewish lesbians managed to live out the war calmly in a village in Vichy, France. But somehow, most other investigators get distracted by Gertrude's charm in her autobiographical writings about the war, or by the pair's silence. Neither Stein nor Toklas ever publicly acknowledge the fact that they were lesbians or Jews. What Malcolm discovers about the pair's wartime immunity isn't complimentary. Stein had an admirer, Bernard Fay, who was an extreme right-wing Catholic and a collaborator. He was responsible for deporting Jews. Fay, who even had a Gestapo agent as a lover, put in a protective word for Stein and Toklas, and so they were allowed to lie low. That Stein would have had such a friend, Malcolm tells us, is no surprise. She herself was an arch-conservative who hated Roosevelt and the New Deal and supported Franco during the Spanish Civil War. What democratic impulse Stein may have lacked in politics, she had in spades in her writing. Stein was hell-bent on resisting the hierarchy that normal sentence structure imposes. Hence, rose is a rose is a rose is a rose. But are books filled with flat sentences like this worth reading? That's the question that any ordinary, time-challenged human being asks upon confronting Stein. Malcolm endearingly confesses that the only way she managed to read Stein's 900-page 1911 opus, The Making of Americans, was to slice up the novel into sections with a kitchen knife. Here's what she ultimately finds once she stops chopping and starts reading. Stein seems to be transcribing rather than transforming thought as she writes. The alacrity with which she catches her thoughts before they turn into stale, standard expressions may be the most singular of her accomplishments. Her influence on 20th century writing is nebulous. No school of Stein ever came into being. But every writer who lingers over Stein's sentences is apt to feel a little stab of shame over the heedless predictability of his own. Malcolm shouldn't be so indirectly hard on herself. Her sentences and the insights they convey have never been predictable. In Two Lives, Malcolm pays tribute to Stein's canny way with words, while at the same time giving us a Stein who may have been somewhat too conveniently canny in her political dealings.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Two Lives, Gertrude and Alice, by Janet Malcolm. If you'd like to catch up on interviews you've missed, you can download podcasts of our show by going to our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Aeneid, Virgil's epic of the founding of Rome, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin about his new book, The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. It contains new information about Bush v. Gore and behind-the-scenes stories about the justices and their opinions. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.